Close enough. I'll make it work.
Horseshoes and hand grenades.
Yeah, it's just match up the waveforms. You know, it's funny, that's how the show started last week.
Match up the waveforms.
Match up the waveforms. You know, I left that part in too. I've been.
Oh, you did? Oh, yeah, I did hear that. I do listen to our own show.
I don't.
And you know what's funny? I'll go, oh, yeah, we did talk about that. I got such a bad memory. It's hilarious.
That's all right. I listened through the edit, and that's it. I'm good with that. I do leave it downloading in like three apps so that we can get the download numbers. So I do cheat on that.
Cheater.
But I won't listen to it again, because once it's enough for me, I can't listen to myself that much. I don't really know how people do it. It's bad enough that when I listen and I have to edit at the same time.
This is true. But I don't talk as much. I need to talk more, don't I?
Well, it is my show.
It is your show. I just kind of tail along.
You're just here. You're the here that tell me where I'm wrong on everything, right? I do give you top billing though. It says Christopher Fikes and Matthew Lanier.
That's just alphabetical.
No, I did it because I wanted you to have top billing.
I don't know why. I guess so. If something goes wrong, it's my fault.
No, it's because, like, if this was, like, a real show, it's like I'm the guy that, like, moves the show along, and you're, like, the expert. That's the way I think of it.
Well, you're the only person that would ever consider me an expert in anything besides BS.
Well, there's AMD. You're pretty good at that.
I do love me some AMD.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that boot kit thing. I don't know what that is, but maybe you can explain
to me. I'm
going to
talk about a couple different things. I got two things with AMD now.
Well, before you get started on that, I got a couple housekeeping items that I need to take care of. First, last week we mentioned that we were moving to Simplecast. That move actually went perfect. Perfect, except the fact that I broke the artwork in the iTunes store and I had to fix that. But that wasn't a big deal at all. But that move went perfect. We are now on Simplecast. The website, educatingtech.net, should point to Simplecast. The subdomain on Simplecast just fine now, and so you'll be able to find the show notes there. And I like it now because it's like, if you want to go to the show notes to this show, you go to educatingtech.net/26. And so I like that. It's not educatingtech/podcast/26 anymore. It's just /26. So if you have any of those old links, like if you go through the Twitter feed and click on some of those links are broken. But that's okay because we're moving forward. And speaking of moving forward, I put out on Twitter that that we were teasing a new thing that we're going to start doing. Some people, I don't know why, but they like to consume audio on YouTube. And so we have taken our podcast episodes and we have converted them to video files, and we have uploaded them all to YouTube. Right now they are all set to private, and that is actually going to, that YouTube channel that we have created is actually going to launch with the release of this episode. And so we'll put the links to that on the website and in the show notes once I actually know that URL. And we'll put it out on Twitter too, so that if you are one of those people that like to consume audio, to each their own, in YouTube, I guess with that new YouTube Red thing, I guess they can play audio in the background now. So, I mean, I guess I can understand it.
I'm actually one of those people that consume audio on YouTube, and I use an app called Blacker for my phone because I don't pay for YouTube Red. And I need it to turn the screen off at night because I don't think my wife would appreciate me having my phone screen on full bright while I'm laying in bed listening to something. And, you know, Blacker, it's a really cool app. If you've got a phone with an OLED screen, go get it, Blacker, and it just turns the whole screen black.
And with OLED screens, it's basically, if it's black, that means the pixel's not lit up, so it's basically off. Even though it's technically off. On, but it's off.
Yep, it works great.
That's pretty neat. But yeah, it's like, I think with YouTube Red, though, it's kind of a good deal, though. With $10 a month, you get, like, access to, like, Google's streaming music service, their streaming thing, and then you get YouTube Red all at the same time. I know another podcaster that he was talked on his podcast that's really the only reason why he doesn't have Apple Music or Spotify is because he subscribes to YouTube Red and he gets the Google Music subscription with that $10 a month. So, I mean, and I'm not much of a YouTube fan. I really only watch it whenever I need to figure out how to do something like removing my oven door or something. So,
it does have some really useful stuff on there. But one thing to think of, remember on YouTube, is there's currently 1.5 billion users on YouTube. And within the next few years, another 3 billion are going to come in.
Yeah, and, that's a potential audience right there.
Oh, yeah, huge. And another thing a lot of people don't realize is the largest website on the internet is Google. Obviously. The second largest is YouTube, another Google property. So, I mean, Yeah, it's huge, and it's only going to get bigger.
Yeah, no matter what your feelings are about Google or YouTube, I mean, it's not going away. And the third biggest is probably Facebook.
Yeah, they're bigger. it's crazy. But, they're not going anywhere, and it's a huge uphill battle for anyone else to come into that space. Just ask Vimeo. I mean, they've been fighting it for years.
Yeah, and, well, I think the only one that's given YouTube a run for their money is Twitch. Because Twitch has the gaming audience, and they've been there, I guess Amazon, since they own Twitch, they have the gaming streaming your games as you play or whatever. And YouTube tried with like YouTube gaming or something, and I don't think it's taken off as well as Twitch is. So, I mean, that's the only thing, and that's only one portion of what YouTube does.
Yes.
And so that's the only product that's ever given YouTube a run for its money on anything. But YouTube is great. I mean, you streamed your graduation on YouTube. I wanted to, but couldn't.
it's good, and the price is right.
Yeah, $50 free.
$50 free.
But if you want to kind of read up as far as like how I took the audio and the album art and kind of meshed it together into a 1080p video, I wrote a blog post about it on twistofmat.com. I'll have the link in the show notes if you kind of want to see how and what. And I use FFmpeg is really what I use. I tried doing it in Final Cut Pro, and it was just, or Final Cut 10 or whatever it's called nowadays. It was too much of a hassle and took way too long. FFmpeg. And once I figured out how to batch do it in FFmpeg, I was just like, set that thing to run, and I went to bed.
Like, I'll see you tomorrow and check on you.
Yeah, and it was all done, and then I just had to individually tag the episodes or whatever and convert them to a file extension that I liked better than MP4, even though it really doesn't matter because YouTube's going to hand you an MOV file if you download it. Or maybe it does MP4. I don't know. Doesn't matter. And then with my fancy new fast internet that Spectrum gave me an update to, I was able to get all those videos uploaded in pretty much no time. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah, if users out there, if you haven't messed with FFmpeg before, it's a fantastic tool. It's on every platform. It's basically a Swiss Army knife for anything audio, video, and can even dump video and audio stuff on the network as different types of streams. It's really cool.
I like it. I like it a lot. And it's a command line tool, so I mean, it takes a little bit getting used to. You just have to learn the commands. But the good thing about it is, I mean, just Google it. You can find whatever you want on FFmpeg. That's essentially what I did. But yeah, very good. And just so you're aware, there may be a little bit of lag time in between the release of the audio on the podcast channel and the YouTube channel, because I may wait till like the next day before I release the actual video portion on YouTube. So don't like expect the YouTube the same day. It may come on Saturday or something like that along those lines. So just to kind of push the audio, and then we'll come back with the video. And plus, if something comes up and it takes me a little while to get the video converted and something like that. So
and if you are listening to the audio stream and then going to the YouTube stream also, man, kudos. Thank you for 2 views.
Yeah, we'll take it. We'll take it. And if you want, just click through all those other episodes and just drag that slider all the way through just to get the view. YouTube ain't going to know that you didn't listen to the whole thing again.
Yeah, but you may find something you missed.
Or you might just like looking at a 1080p version of our album art on full screen on your computer. So, I mean, hey, whatever floats your boat.
I'm still working on Matt over here to see if he wants to like record these hangout sessions.
Not happening. I got a face for radio.
Oh, I do too.
Not happening. But once again, before we get to your AMD stuff, I want to mention something else. A while back, we talked about like backup solutions, and we mentioned the fact that I was trying out, and I think you were too, your backup. I just want to say that this is probably the best backup solution that I've ever used. It is super easy. Like the YouTube price, it's got a great price. It's probably something that when I do have, I'm probably just going to keep using it forever at this point. Restores are super easy. The backups are easy to go, easy to do. I sent you a question yesterday, I think, because you've had a little bit of experience with it before in the past. And I logged into I check it like once a week, and it's like, it has zero problems ever. It's always runs like it's supposed to. And it's like the first time I've ever had a backup service that did that. I mean, it just runs like it's supposed to. And it told me that I had an update. And so I was like, well, if I update the server, will it update the clients? And you were like, I don't know if it would do that or not. And so I got into the documentation where it was like, apparently it does. And so that's just one less thing that I have to take care of. It auto up. You just update the server and the new version installed over the old version. No problems. Everything migrated over to the new version, and then I'm assuming the clients are going to update themselves. And I just cannot say enough good things about your backup. I mean, it's such a good product.
It's great, and the deployment was really simple, wasn't it?
Yes, very easy. I mean, very, very easy. I mean, if you're looking for a new backup solution or looking to replace what you have or looking to get started with some kind of backup, I definitely recommend this. I mean, even if you wanted to do something like at your house and you had like some computer that's running as like a media server, just plug a hard drive into that thing, set up the Your Backup server on it. And I mean, I think it's got a Mac client, and I know it's got Windows and Linux and all that other fun stuff. I mean, it's a great product, and I would even recommend it for home use. It's easy to set up. You just install it. It finds the server part itself on the network as long as it's on the same VLAN. And there are some different things that you can do over routed connections. It's called internet in the settings or whatever, but I mean, it is such a good product. I mean, and restores are easy. I mean, if you can't get the restore in the application to work, you just browse the server, find the files, and copy them over. I mean, because that's all it essentially is. It's so good, and it's so easy.
And it's fantastic. In fact, they do some packages for some NAS clients. So if you are one of those schools that are like rocking a Synology or something of that nature at QNAP, they have packages for that NAS appliance to where you can deploy your backup server directly from that UI within your NAS.
And that's my eventually goal. Right now, I have it running basically and storing everything on the local storage of the servers themselves, because they're packed full of like 6 terabytes of storage themselves, and it's just sitting there not being used. And so I was like, well, it's like, I want to try this out. And I was like, well, I'll just put it there, because I don't want to store it on the sand, because that's kind of not smart to back up to itself. I mean, that doesn't make a lot of sense to do
like
that. And so I'm sort of doing that in a way, but it's at least like if a server, I mean, if the server dies, I lose my backups. It's okay, but I have other backups too. But it's like, and I could probably get the, as long as the hard drives don't fail, I can probably get the data back. But it works out really well, and I'm hoping in the near future I can actually either replace my servers, which it's almost time for upgrade season for those anyway, and basically turn one of them into a backup server, and that's just what its job is. Or get some kind of NAS to attach to my network that basically just need about 4 or 5 terabytes of storage, and I can just use that as the backup, and I just won't have to worry about it. I mean, I literally have not worried about your backup running or having any issues. It's just, it's for me, it has been rock solid.
Yeah, one of those things that I've always, we've always talked about, and this would be a perfect solution for it, was even using it as an offsite, because with your backup, you can also do multiple locations. So you could use your normal internal server that you're using for backup, but also enable the internet server to something that I have on my site to push your files to.
Hey, and I told you, it's like when it's server upgrade time, I'm going to have 3 of these beefed up servers. One of them might end up at your place. So, and we'll find you something to put over here, and we'll throw it in my rack.
Oh yeah. And we'll play with some of those software-defined network tools. That way we don't have to burn one of our precious publics.
Yeah, and then it's, at that point, why, in some ways, why would I need to pay for the offsite backup service that I'm using whenever essentially I'm accomplishing the
offsite.
Same thing? And it'll be faster, it'll be quicker. I mean, in worst case scenario, I drive the 45 minutes up to your school and I go pick up my data and bring it back.
Worst case, you drive up here, slap me in the back of the head because I didn't turn it on or something.
Hey, turn my box on. You lost power, turn my box on.
Yeah. Well, actually, I would actually have a pretty good place for it, because my new high school is 100% backup generator.
Hey, there we go. Perfect. I like it. So I just need to upgrade my servers.
I'd be your offsite, you be my offsite. We'll put floaties on it at your location.
Yeah, you got to put some floaties on it. Or put it up high. We didn't get that much water in the server room, but we did get a little bit of water. So put it up high so we don't have to worry about it. Put it at the top of the rack.
My only requirement is offsite. I didn't say it had to be dry.
Yeah. Yeah, just it's offsite. But does offsite, what if I just burn it all to DVDs and mail them to you? Does that count?
You know, I guess that would count. I mean, the recovery time would probably be a little slow. But.
And the data may be a little bit outdated, but that's all right. But I will say this, and we'll conclude this little follow-up with your backup. I know in this area, and I've kind of experienced it, a lot of technology, school technology people, we've been real shy about dipping our toes into open source software. And a lot of times it's because there's not a lot of support, or there's not a lot of people like want paid support and stuff like that. But don't be scared. Sometimes it's worth it. I mean, there's a lot of open source stuff out there that can do cool things. And I'm not 100% sure if your backup is open source or not, but
oh, it is.
Yeah, but I mean, with the price of free, it kind of makes you think it probably is. But yeah, I recommend it. I mean, just give it a shot. I mean, try it out in a test environment or a lab environment before you put it in production to make sure it works. But don't be scared of the open source stuff. I mean, it was kind of like everybody stayed away from Linux and all this other stuff for a long time, and now we're starting to get into it. So I kind
of
like it.
Never be afraid of the open source. Open source is great.
I think the problem was a few years back, like, I mean, really the only support is you get on their message boards and you ask somebody a question.
And you end up with those people that are the whole RTFM people, and they're just kind of a bunch of jerks.
Yeah, RTFM. And so that's why a lot of people in our area shied away from it, is because that's all you would get. But it's gotten better. It's gotten a lot better. And even documentation on things has gotten a lot better, especially thanks to like DigitalOcean and Linode. That's basically where I get
wonderful documentation.
That's basically where I get all of my Linux documentation from. It's like well written. They must pay their documentation people like a lot of money to be able to do that. So
they must. I mean, because I mean they have stuff that is completely irrelevant to anything that they do documented in there, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, and it's easy to read and easy to understand, and they basically tell you step by step everything that you need to do, and like if something needs to be changed, and they also give you like this is what's going to happen when you do this. If you don't want this to happen, don't do this. They give you those sorts of things, and so they kind of like prepare you for. They don't just like give you the commands and after the fact tell you what the commands do. They tell you beforehand what's going to happen, and then they give you the commands. So, but yeah, embrace the open source. Embrace your backup if you're looking for a backup solution. It's worth it. Worth the price. Let's put it that way.
Oh, definitely worth the price. You can probably testify though that it works way better than Avamar.
Oh yes, I mean yeah, I mean, and it does do image level backups. It just does file backups. It does basically whatever kind of backup you want to do. It'll do it. I mean, you can even get a boot disk that can restore to a bare metal from one of your image level backups. I mean, so I hope I never have to do that, but I can. And so it's just great. And so I need to do that one day. I need to like stand up a VM and try to restore one of the VMs that I'm actually doing, or one of the servers that I'm doing an image level backup on, just to see how it works. And so I need to do that one day.
I think it'd be fun to at least experiment. And hey, maybe we could record that hangouts and do
Well, that'll just be screenshots, so that'll be okay.
Aw.
That'll just be showing the screen.
Okay.
All right, so tell us what you got.
So what's AMD time.
Yeah, what's a boot AMD kit? Time.
Okay, so, you know, AMD released their new Ryzen processors, the 2400 and the 2200 that have the built-in Vega GPUs, and they kind of got a catch-22 problem. New processors that work in old motherboards, but only after there is a BIOS update. But if you're building a new system, how are you going to do a BIOS update when you have an unsupported processor in there? It was kind of like, what do we do?
Yeah, that's kind of weird.
Yeah, and it's a completely understandable. I mean, I understand you can't go back in time and support a processor that was developed a year later. That's just kind of how things are.
Yeah.
But AMD, man, they've really stepped up their game, and what they are doing is they put together what's called a boot kit that customers can go request. And what you do is you go onto their support page and fill out a support request for your processor. They ask for the model number and the serial number of your processor. Make sure you're not just pulling them around, seeing what they're doing.
Yeah.
But you basically just put in your request, boot kit needed. And what they do is they mail you an A6-9800 processor, which is the absolute cheapest AM4 processor with a built-in GPU that was actually around when Ryzen came out. It's a old Bristol Ridge architecture, so it's crappy. It doesn't matter if they get it back. No one wants it. AMD doesn't even want it. It's a horrible product. But it is a supported processor that lets you update the BIOS.
And so basically they send you this CPU, you pop it in, you update your BIOS, and then you pop in your new one?
Yep. And then you're good to go. And what's real funny is they do send you this CPU, and it comes with a heat sink and whatnot because it's a retail box processor. But the only thing they ask for back is the CPU and this little bubble mailer. There you go. They're like, we don't want the heatsink. We really don't even care about the processor, but we just got to ask for it back out of, yeah.
Well, because what they might do is they might refurb it up and package it back up and send it out to somebody else as a boot kit.
I know, but they're not giving the heatsink back, so they'd have to get another heatsink.
Well, yeah, that's true. Well, just send
it
heatsink.
It is bizarre.
Just send it back, too.
I would. But
be like, they're glued together with that paste. Oh, I just send the whole thing.
No kidding. But, I mean, in all honesty, the processor's not worth stealing. I mean, it's a dual core with, like, an R5 GPU from, like, 2010. I mean, it's pretty awful.
And so,
but it is supported and lets you do a BIOS update.
So do you have one of these on the way, or did you get one?
Yes, it should be here today or tomorrow, actually.
Okay, sweet. Well, next week I want to follow up and I want to see, like, start to finish, like, how long this whole upgrade process takes.
It shouldn't take too long. Now, if I could only... What's really going to be sad, though, is the boot kit's going to be in before the motherboard.
Oh, that's what you were saying. Yeah, I got you.
That one piece that everything kind of goes into, you know, the first piece you need is the last piece to arrive.
So, you put that on Twitter today. Will you have, like, a certain amount of time to send this back? You have, like, 10 days or 5 days or something like that before it's got to be back, or just whenever?
They hadn't put any time stipulations on it. I imagine they're just going to say within a reasonable amount of time, but there was no hard time frames associated to it, and honestly, I don't know what the consequences would be because you don't have to put any kind of payment information.
Yeah, that was my next question. That's like the only time I've ever really dealt with somebody sending you hardware that you have to send back. It's like if Dell sends me a part to something and they want the old part back, and it says they like, well, they have all my account information and they'll invoice me or whatever. And so it's like, what do you do? What are they going to do if you don't send it back?
I honestly imagine they have warehouses of this CPU that was manufactured that no one wanted, including themselves, that they're using for this.
Well, yeah, that's probably true. I wonder what happens when they run out of them. What are they going to send out when they run out?
I don't know. You know what? I bet they'll send out the A6-9800 instead of the A4-9600.
But, you know, that's some pretty incredible customer service. I mean, they know releasing this product that there's going to be a problem using it in older motherboards that they say are supported, but mm-hmm. they're going to require an update. So it's like they were ahead of the game. It's like, we know it's coming, and so here's the solution, ready to go.
And I was really proud of the company. I mean, I love the company, but they actually reached out to me over Twitter when I asked the question about it. And so I mean, it was real cool. They monitor social networks for those kind of issues. But in all honesty, it's a real niche problem because most people that are going to be buying the CPU aren't going to actually be buying the CPU. They're going to go to a box store and buy a system that's already made with it.
Yeah. And some motherboard manufacturers are already going to go through the trouble of upgrading the BIOS.
Yeah, it's not going to be that person day one that's so excited about a CPU to come out that they order it the day it comes out.
Yeah, the one that's been talking about it for 25 episodes.
Yeah, but it's here, and I still haven't got to play with it.
Well, that's good. I mean, I like it. I like companies when they go over and aboard for support. I like that.
I do. And I do have to tout a couple more AMD, just two other AMD things. Sorry.
No, that's fine. Go for it.
New processors from them. They're in the embedded market version, so they have the EPYC embedded chips now and the Ryzen embedded. And the Ryzen embedded is basically the low-end Ryzen APU, but these things are going to go into embedded hardware, and Cisco actually already has a partnership with AMD to put these EPYC embedded CPUs in some of their gear, including switches.
Oh, that'll be pretty fancy.
Pretty cool, and some of the demos that they had were like ultrasound equipment using the Ryzen APU combo to get the price down and the performance up. But one of the things that I'm excited about, and as far as the education space to this, is these embedded CPU-GPU combos are ideal for something like a low-cost Windows or a low-cost Chromebook device.
Yeah, and considering they wouldn't be using any kind of Intel processor, I mean, that cuts the price right in half, basically, right there. So,
yeah, so, I mean, it does open the space to perhaps we'll get some lower-cost devices that we can get in student hands that aren't utter garbage, that actually have a decent GPU to do 265 video decoding and those kind of things.
Well, speaking of low-cost devices that aren't utter garbage, let's talk about one that is going to be utter garbage. Microsoft apparently accidentally released the specs or the limitations for Windows 10 on ARM. And my initial readings on this, and since they accidentally done this, it's not available anymore. they pulled the limitations from their website, at least.
Everyone knows that once something hits the internet, it's there forever.
But it's like, but The Verge, where we're going to have the links to, it basically has the six limitations it's going to have. It says only ARM64 drivers are supported, which makes sense. I mean, it's only going to take drivers for the processor that it has. So I mean, you're not going to be installing like some crazy hardware that doesn't have ARM64 drivers for it.
I was about to say, can you imagine trying to load a print driver, a 32-bit Windows XP print driver in this thing and expecting it to work? I mean, come on now.
This is the thing that kind of gets me, and this is bonkers in a way, because the way the industry is going, and coming from the Apple way, Apple has basically said no more 32-bit applications on anything. No more iOS applications that are 32-bit. No more 32-bit applications on macOS. Going from a certain, if you want to run a certain version of their OS going forward, and I think it's the ones that are out now, or maybe the next one for macOS, but no more 32-bit applications. But according to this document, it says 64-bit apps aren't even going to be supported on this Windows 10 with ARM device. And so it's if the whole industry is moving forward with, well, I say whole industry, and usually in the past, whenever Apple has done something, everybody else seems to follow soon after. I don't know if that's going to be the case with this, with the version of the apps, but Apple takes away the CD drive, and so now apparently everybody else wants to take the CD drive away. But or not saying that they were the first, but you know, it's just when Apple's product makes a white ring on a furniture, it's big news. But when other ones have been doing it beforehand, it's...
Well, heck, I was going to say, people even copy that feature. I mean, Sonos copied it.
Well, Sonos was doing it first, but it wasn't a big deal until Apple did it. So
they didn't do it best.
Yeah, and so that's kind of why I say that when Apple does something the industry seems to follow, even though it's kind of joking with the white ring or whatever, but it's like, if they're not going to support 64-bit apps, why bother?
Well, they're you know, The Verge was very misleading the way this was written. When it says X64 apps are not supported, that is talking about the X86 emulation layers not supporting X86 64 apps through emulation.
Oh, I got you.
It's not talking about native ARM 64-bit apps. It's only talking about x86 cross-compiled apps.
Okay, that makes more sense.
It's the real-time emulation. They only have it working on 32-bit, mainly because of the memory requirements to emulate in 64-bits. And there's some real—they're already treading ground with Intel and the x86 license with this emulator with Qualcomm, and I think they're just kind of touching their toes in the water to see how fast Intel sues them.
Yeah, and really, I mean, if you're going to be emulating an emulator— I mean, you don't really want to be emulating too much at one time, you know?
Yeah, because generally to emulate something, you need 10 times the power to properly emulate it. And I really doubt this ARM CPU is going to have 10 times the power of a modern 64-bit processor to do it justice.
Okay, and then, yeah. And then the next thing is that certain games and apps don't work. I mean, that's obvious. I mean, it's not going to be a high-powered gaming machine. I mean, it's an ARM processor. I mean, it might run some games like iOS games that are in the Windows Store. But they'll probably run those just fine that are built for the ARM processor. It says, like, won't use a version of OpenGL later than 1.1.
And that's due, again, to those emulation layers. I mean, these things are very true. That I just don't like how The Verge wrote that second one.
Yeah.
It was kind of misleading.
And it says, apps that customize the Windows experience may not work correctly. I mean, well, a lot of times that when you're coming into Windows customization, that might be getting into, like, kernel-level stuff. And so those things may just not work with the 64-bit kernel or the 68 ARM.
Honestly, I'm okay with nothing being able to modify my right-click menu. That would make me happy.
Yeah, I'm pretty much a defaults kind of guy, too. Just don't want to touch it. apps that assume that all ARM-based devices are running a mobile version of Windows may not work correctly. And, of course, you won't be able to run VMs on it, so... But not like we were expecting it to.
Hyper-V? I mean, come on, guys. But you're not... I mean, I really doubt VTX instructions are inside of this little ARM 64.
But, you know, I wouldn't even do that on my iPad or my iPhone. It's like, I'm not going to run a Windows virtual machine on my iPad. So why would I expect to do it on a Windows 10 ARM device?
I have done it on my Galaxy S8, and it's an abysmal experience.
I'm sure it is. But then again, everything on Android's an abysmal experience. Oh, sorry. Darn. Had to get it in there.
You had to get it. I did get my update for security patches, so I'm at least up on security now. I'm like 12 versions behind in the OS.
That's
so.
Okay though. And you're not going to get it, right? Cuz Samsung
no,
said
just
nope,
not.
We're
it
just
says
not.
Samsung on it. So what it shipped with is what it's going
to
keep.
Yeah. And so my question to you is how is this going to be any different than Windows RT?
Well, they're not doing the artificial limitations where only apps can come from the stores, which is actually the problem with RT, because I had a Windows RT tablet when I was at the Modern Group, and I had done the quote-unquote jailbreak on it, so I could run apps outside of the store, and I ran things like Notepad++, PuTTY, and all that stuff on it like a normal laptop, and it ran just fine. It was just that limitation from the store. I think this thing, what they're trying to do, is they're trying to get those cellular modems in laptops. And this is the most efficient way to do it because these systems on chips already have the modems in them. Intel doesn't make one that has a modem in it. AMD doesn't make one that has a modem in
well,
it.
Well, you say that, but...
Well, they make a modem, but they don't make a system on a chip that
yeah,
has
but,
it integrated.
But Intel has announced that they're working with all these PC manufacturers about putting the new 5G in.
And I guarantee this right here is part of the reason, because that second thing that we were talking about, the x86 emulation, well, that would, if you can get a tablet that is running an ARM chip that's going to run your x86 software, where did the Ultrabook market go then?
Yeah, it's gone.
The Ultrabook market would just be gone.
It's gone. Like the netbooks, gone.
Yeah. But, well, those things needed to go.
But this kind of excites me in more than one ways. I mean, this could be an even lower cost Windows-based machine for
it
a
could.
School. I mean, as long as it could run the... I mean, what do we need from a Windows machine at this point? Because everything we do is in a browser anyway. So, I mean, that's why we can get away with Chromebooks, to do everything. But what does the Windows machine have to do? The Windows machine has to run Office, which they will build. If the x86
it's
version of Office doesn't work, they will build a new version for it, because they would do that. I mean, I think they built a version of Office for RT. And so
they did, and it worked perfect.
And so, I mean, that'll be there, and it's got to run the testing software. Well, if it can emulate x86 apps, there you go, problem solved. It'll do everything that we need, like a Windows machine, to do inside of a school. At least my school district. Other school districts may do some other stuff. I mean, it's not going to be for your video production class or anything like that. But that low cost 1-to-1 device that you may be looking for, this might be a solution.
Yeah, and another thing, I mean, the Windows Store isn't just limited to those universal Windows apps anymore. You can do what they call Project Centennial apps, where the traditional Win32 apps through the Windows Store, which can be controlled through all the policies and whatnot, like for our testing stuff with like the Chromebooks, how you just kind of tick a button and they're suddenly testing machines.
Yep.
Well, if Pearson or whatever, what is their name, ETS. It's a curse word.
Yeah.
But
we
if
don't
they listen. Were to release an
Not
app.
Not very liked around here either.
If they were to release an app in the Windows Store, you'd gain that same flexibility instantaneous without them having to rewrite a single thing.
And, I mean, that works. I mean, there's already apps that are in that Windows Store that are mm-hmm. traditional apps. I mean, and
yeah,
the rumor...
Microsoft Office.
Yeah, and the rumor is iTunes is eventually coming. It ain't coming yet, but it's coming.
Well,
and I think
I don't
Spotify
know if they're
going
to have to do it since S-Mode's now... S mode instead of Windows 10S.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that was the whole motivation factor originally.
So, I mean, but
yeah, Microsoft realized that mode was S.
We'll see. And here's the ultimate bottom line why I like it. Okay. So, I am all about competition, because competition makes everybody better. I don't know if it seemed like this to you, but Google Chrome is becoming the new Internet Explorer 6 to me. And that's not a good thing in a way. It's like everybody's developing everything on the web for Chrome. And that's basically what you had to do a few years back for Internet Explorer 6. It's like it has to work on Internet Explorer 6 because it's like, well, I mean, it's the most popular browser right now. And so in a way, Google Chrome is becoming Internet Explorer 6. And what happens whenever you become the monopoly or whatever? You get lazy and things get stagnant and there's just not a lot of competition, and so competition makes everybody better. Iron sharpens iron, right? and so if we get some low-cost Windows machines, then those companies like Lenovo, or Google's going to work with those companies like Lenovo and Asus and Samsung that are making Chromebook tablets, and it's like, look, hey, Windows is working with y'all on making these low-cost Windows machines. We need to make sure that our Chromebooks are quality-wise just as good. And so I think it's good. I think it'll be good either way. It's going to be good for the Chromebook market, and it's going to be good for the Windows and for the schools that want to stick with Windows and Office 365, because everybody's going to win, because Chromebooks are going to get better hardware and better spec'd out and keep the price down, and then you'll have the low-cost Windows machines that you've been wanting for your Office 365 district. So it's going to make everybody better.
It's great for everyone. I mean, not only is it going to push those software companies, but it's going to push these hardware companies like Intel and AMD even more to make lower power processors. That way they can compete in the space.
And there's really no reason why Microsoft can't succeed with this. I mean, Office 365 is a great product. I mean, we did a whole episode a while back where we talked about if we could do it all over again, if we'd switch. And I think I would. I would go Office 365 just because if the features that are there now were there back then, where it was more of a competitive towards Google Suite, G Suite for education or whatever. If you had the same features that we have now, and Microsoft like allowing the Centennial apps and the traditional apps in the App Store, I mean, because that was Windows Mobile's downfall, right? There was no apps, and because everybody wanted apps,
and it was phenomenal. I mean, Windows Mobile was phenomenal. They had everything right, but they didn't have a user base, so developers didn't write apps. I mean, it is a catch-22 problem. You're not going to get developers without users, and you're not going to get users without apps.
And so at least with the PC side of things and the Windows Store, they're making it easy to put your apps in the PC Store. They're just making it easy. In fact, in some ways, they're probably making it easier than Apple, because they're not requiring any sandboxing rules for PC apps.
So, well, I mean, it does have native sandboxing for all the store apps already, so I mean they just don't expose a lot of those features.
So I think it's great.
I love it.
Go Microsoft. It's just kind of funny that Microsoft accidentally releases them.
I know. I was like, oh, come on. Now, we knew some of those things were going to be there, like Hyper-V and whatnot.
It just makes sense. It's like, you're not going to run a virtual machine on this little bitty janky little laptop. I mean, no.
Well, I mean, the processor doesn't support virtualization, so.
No. But what's going to happen is you're going to run that thing side by side with an iPad, and you're going to find this Windows machine is running just as well as that iPad now.
Yeah. But with this Windows machine, though, I may not be able to run Hyper-V on it, but I can run the Hyper-V manager.
Yeah, and you can yeah, even better. You can manage your stuff. And speaking of managing things, explain to us why Microsoft is embracing Hawaii.
Oh, I love it. They have this, I really don't know where this project came from. It was kind of one of those things that just landed in my newsfeed, and I went and downloaded it. It's called Project Honolulu. I hope they keep the name. It's fun. It's fun to say.
It is kind of nice.
Yeah, but in what it is already, it's a web version of Server Manager.
That's great.
It's great. I mean, I've got a bunch of screenshots that I took to show people what it can do or whatnot, but its main limitations right now is it's doing things on the local machine level and not within the Active Directory environment. So you can manage all these machines' local stuff, like certificates, devices, firewall policies, local users, and you're managing them like you're standing on that machine, like you're sitting there at a console doing it. You have this nice, pretty UI where you get a list of your machines. And you can do all these different things. You can upload files to them. You can pull files off. You can do remote desktop sessions through an HTML5 interface directly through this web page. Remote PowerShell sessions through HTML5, so it doesn't have to be from another Windows device. And it works.
I remember when you told me this, like the first thing that came out of, well, it was chat. So the first thing that came out of my fingers was this is server management on an iPad.
Yeah, and I think it will be very soon. I mean, you can already add and remove server roles and manage those roles on a local basis.
Man, that's pretty intense. That's some pretty intensive tasks to be able to do from a web interface.
It is. And what's real cool is they're not just limiting it to your servers. You can actually add your normal domain computers into it also and get those same kind of insights to them to see like what's going on with the hardware, the processes, control Windows updates, virtual switches, all those things on even your workstations.
And didn't you say you can manage even Hyper-V stuff, or is that coming?
Yeah, no, that's coming. The thing I was most excited about is because, well, I am a Hyper-V environment with Windows clusters, and I pull a Chromebook around with me, and that's not exactly the best tool to manage Hyper-V with. In fact, it's pretty awful to manage Hyper-V with. But within the Project Honolulu, it can manage failover clusters and hyperconverged clusters for those hyperconverged Hyper-V environments right through the browser.
That is, I mean, this is great. I mean, this is a good thing. This is them.
It is a very good thing, and I think what this is stemming from is those Azure teams are doing a lot of other things now, because last year Microsoft released something called the Azure Pack, which lets you install the Azure management tools within your local environment. So you could manage your local environment like you were managing an Azure environment. So if you were a hybrid cloud, your management was consistent across the board. And it was really cool.
Yeah.
And I think this is the next step in that. There's not a huge amount of features in it right now, but the ones that are there work really well. Let me see, what was that one thing? When you go to the overview tab, hey, it's not doing it today. Well, for the past week, I've gone to the overview tab, it crashed the page every time. First you hit refresh and it worked.
Well, it's still in development, so it's understandable.
Oh, yeah, this thing is very, very early, but already it's ticking a lot of boxes on basic things that are management needs that most people need.
Well, here's the thing, too. I mean, this is sort of Microsoft's new idea of, like, Windows everywhere. I mean, Windows as a service or whatever, and they know that a lot of people like you and me, we're managing Windows stuff, but we're not using Windows clients. And so it's almost like they're embracing the iOS and the Mac OS and the Chromebooks. It's like, hey, they're giving us the tools, the companies that use those machines but still want to run the Windows backend. Because, I mean, I wouldn't want to run my environment with Mac OS servers in the back end at all. I mean, there's just.
You mean you don't want to run Open Directory?
No, I don't want to do that at all. I mean, it just I'm used to the Microsoft stuff. It just works great. I mean, maybe if I was an all Mac environment. I mean, even if I was an all Apple environment, I might still run a Windows domain because you can put the Macs on the Windows domain, and plus with Mac basically giving up on server app. I mean, it's pretty much a done deal at this point that Microsoft wins unless you're doing Linux. And like you said, we talked about before, you can do all this stuff in Linux too. Everything that we do on the Windows domain, we can do it in Linux too. It's just Microsoft makes it a little bit easier because we get a GUI. But I mean, this is just like, or even like if you're running Ubuntu, even it's like they're like embracing that other people are managing their stuff and they're not running those devices. And like you said, it's probably the Azure team. They don't really have a whole lot going on right now, and so they just come up with this new thing.
They are the number two hosting provider for servers globally.
Well, that's good.
Of course, Amazon wins one.
Yeah. but yeah, I mean, I think it's great. I've been looking for a solution to do some Active Directory stuff on my iOS device. Not because I want to go iPad only. I mean, I'd love to go iPad only eventually because it's like a light device. It's easy. It's quick. It just works. I don't have to worry about like a whole bunch of stuff. I just get updates every week because Apple finds a new bug. And I said I wasn't going to talk about Apple today, and that's like the third time. That's for some people to go iPad only. I mean, I would like to be able to do more things on my iPad because like, if I go out and about throughout the campuses, a lot of times I don't want to carry the laptop and the laptop bag. It's just I can just go and bring the iPad, and somebody needs their Active Directory username and password reset or whatever. And so I just like log into something real quick, change their password, and we're good to go. And so I've been looking for something that's along those lines that works well, that I can trust. And if I can definitely trust Microsoft stuff because they're building it for their own stuff.
Yeah, and I really think we're going to have those features soon. I mean, the fact that they got the remote PowerShell and the remote desktop working already so early within this product on all the platforms says a lot. I mean, they actually care about it. And I think it's going to go far. And the installation, man, I literally ran an MSI and it was set up.
I think you said, too, it was like a real, like, I think you were actually surprised by the file size of the
thing.
Yeah,
it was like
thing.
43 meg. And I was like,
I mean, considering this is like some web front end, and so it doesn't require like IIS or anything running
nope,
in the back end?
It is not. And in fact, it looks like, just from, you know me, I pick apart the program. A lot of the stuff is written in JavaScript, so it looks like they're using the Node fork. You know, Node.js to run a JavaScript app server side. Mm-hmm. So it looks like they're using the fork that uses Chakra, their JavaScript engine. So it looks like they're running JavaScript server side with this.
That's pretty neat. So you just install it on something, either your computer or a server, and then you just browse it, open it up in Chrome?
Yeah, and it has a couple different modes you can install it with. If you install it on a desktop, it installs in a different mode. It just installs it to where very basic things can be done. If you install it on a server OS, it installs in what's called gateway mode, where you can connect all sorts of other things into it.
That's
pretty
neat.
All from the same MSI, so...
But that's great that Microsoft is doing this. I mean, and you can tell that they're caring more about this stuff because, I mean, the RDP clients for, like, macOS and iOS, they're getting phenomenal. I mean, they're getting really good. They're rock solid. I mean, they're great. The new Remote Desktop 10 that just came out, I think 8 and 10 are both in the Mac store right now. 8 looks kind of traditional, looks kind of old, but 10, the new version, it's like, it's so good. The only thing it's missing is I just need them to find some way to sync all of my connections between all of my devices.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Golden.
But
I think you can do that if you have some kind of RDP gateway server set up or something, and you just log into that, and then there's all your stuff.
Yeah, either Guacamole or hopefully Project Honolulu soon.
So, I mean, that's just great. I mean, I love it.
I do too, and if anybody from the team ever hears this show, good job. Man, I really like this product already.
I'm going to have to give this a shot because the last time you recommended something like NetXMS, I mean, that changed my life. I mean, I am blown away by that application.
Yeah, it's great. And I do believe that I recommended your backup a couple years ago, too.
You probably did because...
It was just really, really ugly then. And someone came by and made it pretty.
Yeah, it is very nice. It's got a nice little web interface. I like it. But yeah, so everything web interface, Project Honolulu, manage your servers with web interfaces, and then, but you know, I kind of get why you say it was a little bit different for desktop mode, because if you're on a desktop, just run Server Manager. I mean, you already got that. You don't need the...
But you want to know something really funny, though? All my testing has been from a Windows 10 machine connecting to the web interface for Project Honolulu, so I mean, yeah.
It's like, what's the point?
Why not?
Why don't you open it up and let me have access to it and let me fiddle around with your servers? How about we do that?
Well, I'm kind of scared to do that because the only ones I connected are my primary AD controller and my clusters.
Oh, well, yeah, you don't want to give me access to that because I'll just mess your world up one day. But speaking of messing our worlds up, we'll finish out this episode. Let me tell you what I've been dealing with the past couple of days. We did mock star testing today, and star is our online, standardized testing in Texas that we're going to do. We did mock testing because this year things are a little different as far as like locations because of our the way we are arranged in our school. And we did, for the first time, we're going to attempt to do testing on Chromebooks. And so with the mock testing, they did the little practice test on the Chromebooks. And basically, it ran basically like the test is going to run on the actual test day. And apparently, I was having some Chromebooks getting kicked off the Wi-Fi. And I really have no explanation as to why this is happening. It seems to be isolated to like one part of the building because they were testing in another part on some Chromebooks and they had like zero issues on there. And so you already know about this because your suggestion is like, well, we need to do a spectrum analyzation. Is that a real word? Analyzation? Analyze the spectrum.
Analyzation. Yeah, we'll analyze the spectrum.
Analyze the spectrum. And so I was like, well, let's figure out how to do this. And you're like, well, figure out how to do it with your controller. I was like, okay. And so I did some digging and I found out that I could put, that Cisco actually makes a thing called Wi-Fi Spectrum Expert or something. It's a discontinued product, but it can still install on a Windows machine. So I threw it on my little VM. And you can actually put your access points in a mode that supports it. I think it's called the Cisco Clean Air. If you run Cisco, a lot of people use Aerohive, or some people are crazy enough to use Aruba.
Which is awesome, by the way.
It may have some like different names. I don't even know if like Aruba can do this, but I just know my Cisco can. I had to use.
Hold up. I'm going to go ahead and stop you. What were the screenshots from that I was sending you? I think those were from my Aruba controller.
Yeah, you were doing it straight from the controller.
No dog in the Aruba, even though HP owns them, which still hurts to say.
So you can throw the access point in this mode called SE mode. And I think it only supports like the newer access points, like the 2600 series and like the 3600 series. I've read somewhere that maybe you can do it on like a 3500 series, but I think really you can only get like 26 or 36s right now. And so I have some 26, like inside that classroom, I have a 2602i, I think. And so whenever they were done testing yesterday, I threw that access point in a mode called SE mode, or SE Connect is what it's called, SE-Connect. And so the AP reboots, and then when it connects back to the controller, gets its, all its little stuff, it gives you like this little key. And so you open up the application, Wi-Fi Spectrum Expert. You say you connect to a remote sensor. You put in the IP address of the access point, and then you put in the key that it gives you, and the key changes on every reboot of the access point, which is, I guess, a security thing, or that's just how SSH works. But I don't know. One article I read said it was an SSH key, but I don't think it was.
Yeah, unless they're regenerating the keys every time it reboots.
Yeah, but so you pop that in, and then all of a sudden, you pick what spectrum you want to analyze, 2.4 or 5.0 gigahertz. So I started with the 2.4 because, you know, that's just what you do. You start with the lowest and you make your way up. And then you just see all the pretty charts. And you called it the waterfall graph, I think. And
yeah, the waterfall chart.
It was very pretty. And the uglier it is, or the prettier it is, the worse your interference is, apparently. If you have straight lines, you're good. But if you have everything all pretty and colored, that's when things are bad. And come to find out, it's like I've got something's in there doing. I have on each channel that it scanned on the 2.4 gigahertz range, there is at least three or four interference devices or something that's interfering with each one of those channels. And so I'm thinking that that may have to do with why it was disconnecting. And come to find out, I was in there and the teacher was in there and she was like, "What are you doing?" I was like, "Well, I've had some of these problems. This is what it was doing." And so I'm running the scan to see if it's something going on in this room or not, because it's kind of leaning that way. And she says, "Oh, yeah, that happens every once in a while. We just move the kid and it works after we change their seat." So it's like, well, that would have been good to know.
Yeah, it's one of those things. Why weren't you saying there was a problem? I don't know what's there unless you tell me.
Yeah. And so, this Wi-Fi interference, I mean, it could be coming from anything. I mean, there's no microwave in the room, so it's not a microwave. But, I mean, it could be a ballast in the light. It could be some electrical cables running through the wall. I mean, it could really be anything. The spectrum analyzer was telling me that it was a lot of like Bluetooth stuff for some reason. I don't know. And like as a trial thing, I like disabled all the Bluetooth on the Chromebooks anyway, thinking maybe they were like interfering with each other. But the problem reoccurred. And so there's something crazy going on then in that room in the 2.4 gigahertz range. And so basically my solution was I just killed it. I just turned it off. Everything is
2.4 gigahertz anyway.
Yeah, everything on that network is 5.0, on that SSID is just going to have to be forced to connect at 5.0 gigahertz, which is, it's good in a way because obviously 5.0 doesn't go as far as 2.4, so it's going to like cut down on connecting to access points a room over because the signal won't be as good. And so I won't have to like dial down any kind of power settings or whatever. Cisco's controller will probably just take care of that for me. And I just, like you said, legacy devices, they just won't have an opportunity to connect anymore, which I did find a laptop. I had one laptop that apparently did not have a compatible Wi-Fi card in it.
Where did that laptop come from?
I have no idea. I don't think it's that old. I mean, that thing can't be more than 6 years old. I mean, I don't think it's that old. So maybe it just needs a driver update or something, and the radio's just turned off for some reason. So, but I made that work by turning 2.4 back on to another network, and they connected to that just fine. And so it was okay. But I'm going to run with that. But I'm also going to recommend, hey, let's not do Chromebook testing in those rooms because there's some Wi-Fi interference. If possible, let's move them to another location. And I'm also going to do some more testing. One day I'm just going to go sit in there and go through the practice test again with one of the Chromebooks. And I did it, but I went through it quick because I just guessed on all the answers and just hit next, next, next to go all the way through the test to see if it would kick me out. One day I just need to take the time and actually like go through it about the speed the kids were, the 2 hours or so that it takes them to do it. And just find out maybe like if it is that, and then maybe try it in a different location. But I'm leaning, it's either that, this was the two differences between the two classrooms that were doing it. Besides the location, where they were testing and it was working fine, there wasn't even an access point in that room. It was connecting to the room over. And so, but this was like an old counselor's office, or an old nurse's office, and it was only like a few kids. The other room had like 12 kids in it, and the one next to it, where they were also having trouble, had like 15 kids. But I mean, at any given time, I've had 30 Chromebooks turned on in a classroom at a single time. And so I don't think it was like a Wi-Fi being too many devices connected to it. And plus it's Cisco. I mean, anything can handle like 60 if you really wanted it to. I mean, so, and that, and the only other difference between the location is it was a different model Chromebook. It was an N22 as opposed to an N21, but they have the same Wi-Fi card in it. I mean, the logic board's a little bit, or motherboard's a little bit different than the two. And I only know that because when you change the keyboard, the little connectors are in a different place. So it's a little bit different, and I think the screen connector is different on the motherboard for the N21 and the N22. But other than that, I mean, it should be the same thing. I mean, it was connecting to the same VLAN, same everything, and so it was just kind of weird that one location was having problems and another one wasn't. So I'm kind of leaning towards it being the building. And, you know, it was like outside walls. So, I mean, they could be pulling something in from outside. Maybe there's like an air conditioner unit or something outside those windows that were interfering. I mean, it could just be anything. But
yeah, that's what's real fun about the spectrum analyzers. Is it doesn't just show you Wi-Fi networks. It shows you radio noise.
Yeah, and at first I was like, well, why don't I just use this application I have on my Mac called Wi-Fi Explorer or something like that, and so and just kind of scan. But all that does is scan the 802.11 whatever. And that's the only thing it scans. It doesn't scan everything else. And so that was just a really neat trick that you showed me, and I appreciate it. I'm going to actually probably use that a lot if I have some problems with Wi-Fi. And like you said, you actually carry one in that mode already ready to go. And so maybe I need to cough up $600 or whatever and buy another access point to be able to do that. But that's just really neat. That was a really cool. And the graphs were real pretty. I really like that. That was kind of cool.
I love the waterfall charts. And for those that don't have a controller that's capable of this, there is a project online called RTL SDR, and basically what it is Realtek SDR. A lot of those DVB TV tuners that are used for capturing over-the-air television in Europe are actually software-defined radios that you can throw into another mode and use open-source software to be radio receivers for any type of connection. But along with that, you can also not be a connection and just be looking at the radio space and get a whole waterfall chart the same.
Yeah, and I guess the application, the Cisco thing, was free. I mean, I don't...
It was free.
It was free. It was free from somehow. But we got it. And I think you can download it from Cisco.com. And if not...
You can.
If not, hit me up on Twitter. We might work something out.
Oh, there you go. But yeah, those interested, though, the RTL SDR... receivers are generally $5 and less. So
yeah, and we'll throw some links to that in the show notes too. And so, but yeah, that's just sort of something crazy that I had going on this week. I just had to deal with some Wi-Fi. So definitely going to see about moving them to another location, more centralized inside the building, away from outside walls. Maybe that'll help. So or hopefully we might be in a location. We might be in actually different locations completely as far as come testing time. We might actually have our portable building set up, and so we might have some people back in their home
campuses.
Fingers
crossed for you.
Yeah, we're getting there. The other portable building, the high school one that we're getting, actually showed up. It's in a parking lot at the stadium, so it's getting here. So as long as if we can just get it to quit raining, well, it's not really raining here, but we can just get the ground to dry up so they can start setting these portables, it'd be all right.
Yeah, I think you walk outside and go knee-deep right now, just about
everything. Everything's quicksand. It's like, I mean, you can't really throw what it's called, what, slag? Is that what it's called, slag?
Mm-hmm.
You can't throw slag on a wet ground and put something heavy on top of it and not expect it to sink. So
you just make a small.
I mean,
lake.
I'm not an engineer or a civil engineer or whatever, but I mean, I'm not very good with power tools. But I mean, that just sort of makes sense to me. Don't put something heavy on something that's wet because it's going to sink. But yeah, but that's our show this week. If you want to hit the show notes, you can get educatingtech.net/26. That's pretty neat. We'll just throw that out there again because it's Simplecast. Love it. You can find Chris on Twitter at @feeks, and I'm at @twistofmatt. Chris is actually being a little bit more active on Twitter. I'm proud of him. You can reach the show notes.
I'm trying to be more social.
You're building your brand. That's what you're doing. You're building your brand. You got some things in the works that's kind of exciting, so maybe you can get some of those out there. But you can reach the show at educatingtech and then or educatingtech@gmail.com. Hey, I said it right the first time. If you want to send us an email, like I said, if you want the Cisco application and you can't find it, just hit me up and I'll hook you up with something.
It may make its way to America.
Yeah, we'll put it somewhere. I'll put you in touch with the Cisco representative, quote unquote, to be able to get it purchased. How about that?
There we go.
And then so, but yeah, but that's our show, and I guess we'll see you next week. See you later, Chris.
See you later, Matt.